Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
These discussions with paramilitaries were at play with death.
Remarkable personal stories from around the world.
They don't speak with words, they speak with guns.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and at 13 hours GMT on Friday, the 26th of April, these are our main stories. The US Secretary of State meets President Xi in Beijing and raises concerns about Chinese support for Russia.
China's the top supplier of machine tools, microelectronics, nitrocellulose, which is critical to making munitions. Russia would struggle to sustain its assault on Ukraine without China's support.
The US military starts building a floating pier to get aid into Gaza. And the first personalised vaccine to defend against melanoma skin cancer. Also in this podcast, you've heard about blood diamonds. Now lawyers challenge Apple over its alleged use of blood metals. Haitians wake up to a new political reality, but how much hope does it really hold? And
Twain turned around because she wanted to and was interested. And looks like curiosity and communication and intelligence go together.
How talking to Twain, the humpback whale, could help us communicate with aliens from outer space. It was a chance for China and the US to stabilise relations, with the American Secretary of State Antony Blinken having concluded the official part of his visit to China. It seems things are on a more even keel. After his meeting with Mr. Blinken, the Chinese President Xi Jinping said the two economic superpowers had no choice but to work together.
The two countries should be partners, not rivals. They should achieve mutual success, not harm each other. They should see common ground. Instead of vicious competition, they should be true to their words and be resolute in their actions, rather than saying one thing and doing another.
But Mr. Blinken's meetings with Chinese leaders also brought the tensions between the two to the surface. Mr. Blinken addressed several of those areas of disagreement, including Chinese support for Russia's war against Ukraine.
The United States is very clear-eyed about the challenges posed by the PRC and about our competing visions for the future. In my discussions today, I reiterated our serious concern about the PRC providing components that are powering Russia's brutal war of aggression against Ukraine. China's the top supplier of machine tools, microelectronics, nitrocellulose, which is critical to making munitions and rocket propellants. Russia would struggle to sustain its assault on Ukraine without China's support.
Our correspondent in Beijing, Stephen McDonald, gave us his assessment of what Mr. Blinken had to say.
Perhaps I should start with the most contentious thing I think he said, which was he had some very strong words regarding what the US says is China's backing for Russia in its war in Ukraine. And the way he says China's doing this, he said that it's supplying machine tools and other dual-use items which could be used in weapons or to be used in the machinery which makes weapons. Now, he's called on Beijing to rein in these companies that are providing this stuff to Russia, but he said if China doesn't address this, we will. Now, he didn't explain how the US would address this, but I can only imagine it's something like sanctions on the Chinese companies supplying this stuff to Russia. He said that in the past, China had exerted influence on Russia, for example, in discouraging Russia from using nuclear weapons in Ukraine. Praised China for doing this. So he said, you know, you've done this before, so maybe it's time for an action like this again. So some kind of a sort of stern warning, if you like, and maybe now Washington's going to wait and see if China does deliver on this.
That's so interesting. I mean, lots and lots of diplomatic language with one or two of these sharp jabs in amongst it all from Antony Blinken. What do you think the Chinese will make of that? He's standing there in Beijing giving a news conference with these harsh messages, but also saying he wants more cooperation.
Well, funnily enough, that's their message too, though. So the readout we've seen from the Chinese side in these meetings is quite similar. Harsh words for the US supplying weapons to Taiwan. Beijing would say that's inflaming tensions across the Taiwan Strait, and yet praise for these other areas where they can cooperate with one another. I mean, I think what is remarkable is that despite all these tensions, the atmosphere, if I could put it that way, in Beijing, like if you spoke to taxi drivers and said, what do you think of the Blinken visit and what have you, it's not animosity towards the US government. And I think people would welcome the talks because both sides have said they need to explain very clearly where their points of disagreement are, because otherwise it could be quite deadly. And in the words of Wang Yi, Anthony Blinken's opposite number, they can either cooperate with one another or they can let the relationship collapse and drift towards conflict. And what he's referring to there is the danger of, say, in the South China Sea or around Taiwan, a battle or a war breaking out between the world's superpowers that they don't want to actually fall into. And some small misunderstanding could lead to a much bigger military conflict. And so this is why, for example, they've renewed military-to-military communications.
Stephen McDonnell with me from Beijing. A revolutionary new vaccine is being trialled in the UK, designed to target melanoma skin cancer. The treatment, which uses the same mRNA technology as some COVID jabs, works by telling the body to hunt down cancer cells and prevent them from returning. Our health correspondent Michelle Roberts told me how it's tailored to the individual patient.
What they do is they take out the cancer from the patient, they take it to the lab, they carefully look at it, and then they design this cancer vaccine for that specific cancer. And the idea is to try and stop any leftover cancer cells that might still be lingering. So that's what they're hoping to do. There's trials going on. It's a phase three trial, which is the one to see how well it's actually working. And it's going on in a few different countries, including the UK. And one of the first people in the UK to try it is Steve Young, who had a melanoma growth on his scalp removed about a year ago.
Okay, someone told me I've got survivor syndrome because I actually feel guilty. I feel guilty that I'm completely fine and yet I'm getting all this attention, and I get to have a scan and an MRI every 3 months when I know that people are waiting such a long time, and I genuinely feel kind of awful about that. But I just really hope that what's happening with the trial and the results they get are going to be good news, and it's going to go on to do amazing things.
He's one of the patients on the trial. Other countries, including Australia and the US, are also recruiting people to try it. Only some of the patients will get the real cancer vaccine. Some will get a dummy shot, so they don't know which one they've got. But the hope is that it will stamp out any remaining cancer cells, which would be a real game changer.
We saw in COVID times just how quickly this stuff can be developed when the pressure is on. For people listening who are thinking this treatment could help me, what sort of timescale are we talking about on this?
So this is a phase three trial, which is kind of the last step, if you like. They're looking to see how effective it is. So they've done earlier safety trials, which look really good. And it will still take some time. That's the unfortunate thing. It takes time to get all the patients to run the trial and then to number crunch the results at the end and publish them. So we are talking years still, although the technology, as you say, through the pandemic, I mean, that was one of the really good payoffs, was that science moved forward quite a lot. And this is one of the fortunate outcomes that we've now got this mRNA technology that looks like it can be really good for tackling cancer. And that's really important.
And could be presumably used in a whole range of conditions. We're just at the beginning of the process, as I understand it, of exploring what mRNA tech could do.
Yeah, so researchers are looking at other cancers too. They're looking at kidney, lung. And what it's doing is teaching the body how to use its own immune system to fight the cancer cells.
Our health correspondent, Michelle Roberts. You've probably heard of blood diamonds, precious gems mined in a war zone and then sold to finance an insurgency, an invading army's war efforts, or terrorism. Today come allegations of a new type of exploitation of conflict zones, blood metals. The government in the Democratic Republic of Congo is accusing the tech giant Apple of using minerals illegally mined from the east of the country, an area that suffered years of armed conflict. Lawyers for the DRC PRC have written to Apple warning of legal action if the alleged practice continues. The French lawyer, William Bourdon, is one of those representing the Congolese government. He told my colleague Victoria Uwanhunda the logic behind the letter.
If Apple has done the right job and has taken the good measures, they could not have continued to exploit these minerals. All their strategy is to try to convince the consumers of the world that they have anticipated on the risks, they took the good measures and in good faith, and they could not do more and best. In reality, they did not make the good job, because if they had made the good job, they would have been obliged to stop all exploitation of these blood minerals.
What are these blood minerals? Can you break them to us?
You remember blood diamonds? We can duplicate blood minerals. Blood minerals, it's a long story. It's an old moon for all the civil society. It's a kind of black box. This part of the world where, like a cancer, militias, army groups, since years and years, have committed the worst crimes. So these are strategic minerals which were needed by all the high-tech giants. And they are exploited north of Congo in conditions equivalent to the commission of international crime. Some of them, of this mineral, are transferred by illegal avenues. And it's very important to understand that this instruction, which have been given by DRC, why Apple? Because Apple, of course, is a giant, because we were able to documentate very precisely all the facts, which is the background of our notice. And this is the first move of a new policy of the DRC, who want to moralise the way in which the raw materials are exploited in this country.
Responding to the allegations, the tech giant Apple referred the BBC to statements from its 2023 annual corporate report, saying, based on our due diligence efforts, including analysing the information provided by third-party audit programmes, upstream traceability programmes and our suppliers, we found no reasonable basis for concluding that any of the smelters or refiners of 3TG determined to be in our supply chain as of December the 31st, 2023, directly or indirectly financed or benefited armed groups in the DRC or adjoining country. No, we won't sell TikTok is the blunt answer from the Chinese tech company ByteDance, which owns the hugely popular short video platform. This follows reports they'd intended to do just that in order to comply with a new law in the US threatening to ban it there. Our business reporter Suranjana Tiwari has more.
This statement was in response to US media reports that ByteDance is looking for scenarios to sell TikTok without the powerful secret algorithm that recommends videos to its more than 1 billion users around the world. Posting on a Chinese social media platform it owns, ByteDance said foreign media reports about ByteDance exploring the sale of TikTok are untrue. ByteDance does not have any plans to sell TikTok. Now, TikTok, of course, has been a political and diplomatic hot potato for years. The US is concerned it would hand user data over to the Chinese government, although TikTok says it has not and will not share US user data with Beijing. Critics say the algorithm is also a problem and its ability to influence Americans, and the latest development being this bill that US President Joe Biden signed into law this week calling for a sale or a nationwide ban. TikTok plans to sue and could take the case all the way to the Supreme Court, which could take years. But there are a lot of issues with a potential sale as well. Finding a buyer for such a valuable company would be a challenge, and anyone with deep enough pockets, like Facebook's parent Meta or Google, would prompt competition concerns. But also there is a grey area over that powerful algorithm. Beijing says the technology is protected and would oppose any forced sale of TikTok, saying it will take all necessary measures to protect Chinese companies.
Suranjana Tiwari reporting. Still to come, pro-Palestine protests continue at US universities.
No matter how young we are, no matter how few people we could possibly be, we're still going to show up and do all that we can for the people in Gaza who don't have a voice right now.
There's no sign of an end to Israel's military operation in Gaza. Indeed, there are continuing reports of an imminent ground assault on the southern city of Rafah. Aid agencies say the civilian population faces a dire situation. But there is a glimmer of hope today. The US military has started building a floating pier off the coast of Gaza to boost the supply of humanitarian aid. Pentagon spokesman Major General Pat Ryder gave more details at a news conference.
As an update for our humanitarian assistance support operations to establish the maritime corridor off the coast of Gaza, I can confirm that U.S. military vessels, to include the USNS Benavidez, have begun to construct the initial stages of the temporary pier and causeway at sea. We're aware of the significant interest in this important effort and will provide much more information in the very near future as we work alongside the international community to rush aid to the people of Gaza.
Our diplomatic correspondent James Landale is in Jerusalem and told me how it's going to work.
The plan essentially involves everything beginning in Cyprus. Aid will be delivered there to a big holding area in the port. It will be sorted out. It will be checked by Israeli forces and it will be put onto very large commercial vessels that will take the aid south a couple of hundred nautical miles to a large floating platform that is, as you said, the Americans have just said they are now in a position to start building that large floating platform. The aid will then be taken off the ships onto that platform and put into trucks. Those trucks will then be driven onto landing craft of varying sizes. Some of them can hold 15 trucks, some of them slightly smaller, just 5 trucks. Those vessels, those little landing craft, will then shuttle the aid onto a second floating platform, a floating causeway that will be several hundred meters long. This will be attached to the shore, anchored in the sand, and those trucks will then drive along the causeway and then up onto the beach into a secure zone there, deliver the aid to that secure zone, and then turn straight back and head back out to the floating platform.
Right, so this gets more aid in. But actually, when this was first suggested, the general sense from other countries was, well, why don't you just allow more aid in by road? Because that would be more effective.
Yeah, and this whole idea initially was floated as a way of putting pressure on the Israelis to open up more land aid routes. They have subsequently done that, not as much as governments and aid agencies want, but things have improved a bit. But this maritime route is only one part of the delivery route. If you're talking about need involving, you know, at least 500 trucks a day, the Americans are saying this particular maritime route, at its best, will be 150 trucks a day. So it's part of the solution, not the whole solution.
James Landale in Jerusalem. With feelings running high about the situation in the Middle East, student protests have been happening at more and more university campuses in the United States. At Columbia University in New York, campus authorities and students are locked in stalemate over the removal of a tent encampment. Protests and encampments have also been organised at universities in Boston, Atlanta, and at Princeton, New Jersey. Yasmin is a student at the University of Texas.
I'm here to support my fellow Palestinians and all the students who came out yesterday, faculty as well, all the people who got arrested. I think they need to know that they have a community that loves them and that's here for them. I think by coming out protesting peacefully here, it shows that there's a big amount of people who do care about this. It's not something that we're going to just let slide. No matter how young we are, no matter how few people we could possibly be, we're still going to show up and do all that we can for the people in Gaza who don't have a voice right now.
Our North America editor Sarah Smith has been to Columbia.
What happens is every time the police are brought on to campus, several more protests strike up in what now feels like a nationwide movement. It's getting real momentum behind it. We are reaching the end of term, but certainly the ones I spoke today said that, you know, that was not going to stop them from maintaining their protest and this tented encampment that they've set up there. It does mean possibly the focus of this will shift to graduation ceremonies. We've seen the University of Southern California just announce that they're massively scaling back their graduation ceremony because they're worried about it being disrupted by protests. And I think you could see that happening at campuses across America through the summer. I met a number of Jewish students as well who've set up their own little kind of corner of the campus in Columbia University where they've sellotaped onto the wall photographs of all the Israeli hostages currently being held by Hamas and signs demanding to release them now. And they told me that they felt intimidated and harassed by the fact of these protests being on their campus and then having to walk past them.
I have felt extremely physically unsafe, very distracted from my schoolwork, very worried for all my other fellow Jewish students that look more Jewish than I do, because there have been a lot of emotional and physical assaults to them based on the way that they look. And it has just been extremely disappointing to walk into a school, a place where I deserve to be here and to learn and feel like my voice and maybe my story and the way that I feel about what's going on doesn't really matter.
There have been incidents of anti-Semitic behavior at a lot of the protests, but the protesters will all tell you that these are limited in number and that they crack down on it whenever possible. And I met several Jewish students who were actually part of the pro-Palestinian protest at Columbia University, who say they don't think there's anything anti-Semitic about what's going on there and that their presence as part of that encampment ought to be proof of that. So there are feelings running incredibly high on all sides. And what was obvious being there was that this is completely dominating campus life.
Our North America editor, Sarah Smith. Haitians woke on Friday to a new political reality following the creation of a new transitional council that's meant to steer the troubled country towards calmer waters and fresh elections. All this after Prime Minister Ariel Henry resigned in the face of implacable hostility from, among others, the gangs that now control most of the capital, Port-au-Prince. This resident of the city told us of her hopes and fears.
Lots of Haitians are not very hopeful that this will turn our current situation around. We still, in our hearts, have faith that hopefully the people, the seven members now, that they will at least create a safe environment for us to be able to go to work, for our kids to be able to go to school, and for us to continue living in peace and without the worries and the trauma that we live on a regular basis.
Matthias Pierre is a former minister for elections. He gave us his thoughts on the challenges facing Haiti's new rulers.
This is not the ideal solution. It's going to be a very challenging situation, but at the same time, it's a beacon of hope. We hope that these people from different groups will find the necessary consensus to address the big challenge that Haiti is facing at the moment. And the big test, the members has to sit together and pick among themselves one president. After the pick, who's going to be the president, they have to agree on one prime minister who's going to really leading the country and the government. And the next biggest decision is to put together a commission of experts to address the biggest challenge, which is the security issue. And the last one is picking the members that will form the Electoral Council to organize the elections. I think that's where the real battle is going to be. There's a real challenge in there among these people on how to put the country first in every decision so things could happen.
Daniel Foote is a former US special envoy to Haiti and has this sobering analysis of the future facing Haitians today.
I hope they are successful, but hope is not a strategy. And I think that's the international community's strategy right now for Haiti, because they chose the seven non-observing people on the presidential council. So therefore, the people in Haiti don't feel that they had a say in this. And probably the mortal sin of the whole thing is the United States forced the council to include the current ruling party since 2011, which has driven Haiti absolutely into the ground and is hated and reviled across the country. If the goal is eventual elections whose results are accepted by the Haitian people, then it's critical that there's credibility and the possibility of trust between the people and this interim provisional presidential council. The other problem is the internationals have forced the Haitians into this power-sharing agreement, which they've never been successful with. So instead of uniting for the betterment of Haiti, they've come together in a seven-way arm wrestling contest for eventual power of the country. And that usually only has one outcome in Haiti, and it's bad.
The former U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti, Daniel Foote. Sri Lanka says it'll hand over the management of what was once described as the world's emptiest international airport to a company with Indian and Russian ownership. The move is an attempt by the government to reduce losses from state enterprises following an unprecedented economic crisis in 2022. Anbarasan Etharajan has more.
The $209 million Mathala Rajapaksa International Airport in southern Sri Lanka was built with Chinese funding in 2013, but it has been struggling due to a low number of flights and persistent financial losses. The Indian and Russian companies will manage the airport for 30 years, but the value of the deal has not been mentioned in the government statement. It was one of the big infrastructure projects built with a $4.2 billion Chinese loan during the tenure of President Mahinda Rajapaksa. The airport is located close to a wildlife sanctuary, and the Sri Lankan military were once forced to deploy hundreds of troops to clear deer, wild buffalo and elephants off the airport's runway. Colombo has already handed over the seaport in Hambantota to China on a 99-year lease after struggling to repay money borrowed for the project. The Sri Lankan government defaulted on its foreign debt in 2022 and the economic crisis triggered widespread protests.
Now, everyone loves a whale. Today, though, news of a world first, as scientists in the US say they've actually had a conversation of sorts with a humpback whale in Alaska. She's called Twain. Whale sounds do have an undeniably magical quality, don't they? But there is more to the scientists' chat with Twain than that. They've used their experiment as a dummy run for communicating with aliens. Victoria Uwanhunda spoke to two of the scientists involved, Dr. Lawrence Doyle of the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, or SETI Institute, and first Dr. Fred Sharp of the Alaska Whale Foundation.
By understanding the signals and the meaning of their vocalizations, it allows us to have better bedside manners in their hours of need, say when there's an entanglement or live stranding. And these signals are very important. By understanding more about these animals, we can understand more elaborate communication systems, and that allows us to build better filters for parsing cosmic signals out there in the universe.
And Dr. Doyle, if I may bring you in, tell us more about this alien communication. How does that work?
The basic idea is, you know, when you can't go to Mars, you use Antarctica as a proxy and you do experiments under the extreme cold and conditions in Antarctica. And it just occurred to me that if we are going to detect intelligence from, you know, signals from space, that we should practice on non-human signals on Earth. And so there are millions of communication systems on Earth, and we thought we'd start with humpback whales because they depend largely on audio for their communication. They're a very complex species. They have kind of a global communication system. And so we decided to start with them. And we had this idea that there was a contact call. So you start by saying hi. And we were surprised that the whale turned around and said hi back and stuck around for about 20 minutes. And we only cut off communication because that's how long our permit allowed. But the whale did not lose interest and went off vocalizing, trying to say hello again. So although it was very simple, it was amazing what that unfolded with our attitude. If we ever get an extraterrestrial signal, what we're going to be faced with.
It was
very sobering.
How was that first communication with her? Like, as you say, when she said hello back?
Well, yes. Brenda McCowan, our colleague, was at the controls of the speaker that was transmitting. And she said she's never had an experience like that in 30 years of studying animal behavior. The thing is, humpback whales don't do it for food. They eat, you know, a ton a day of herring or krill. And so Twain turned around because she wanted to and was interested. And one thing we were able to help SETI right away with the incident was, looks like curiosity and communication and intelligence go together.
Dr. Lawrence Doyle, and before that, we also heard from Dr. Fred Sharp. And that's all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition of the podcast, drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, or on X, you'll find us there as @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Craig Kingham. The producer was Mark Duff. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
I'm Katia Adler from the Global Story podcast, and we're looking at this summer's Paris Olympics and Paralympics. Hosting the Games puts a lot of pressure on a city. This means hosting isn't quite as appealing as it once used to be. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Was ist noch besser als ein guter Plan? Die Möglichkeit, ihn zu ändern. Mit integrierter KI bietet Workday kontinuierliche Innovationen, die Ihnen helfen, agil zu bleiben, egal was passiert. Workday, the finance and HR system for a changing world.
I'm Katia Adler from the Global Story podcast, and we're looking at this summer's Paris Olympics and Paralympics. Hosting the Games puts a lot of pressure on a city. This means hosting isn't quite as appealing as it once used to be. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.